This is Liquidity Talks, a live stream and podcast series designed to share the latest trends and updates from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk. Join us as we power up the liquidity conversation.
Hello and welcome to our latest installment of Liquidity Talks live stream and podcast. I'm Neville Roberts. I'm the CEO and founder of Planix, the market-leading fintech focused on real-time treasury, liquidity and risk. Now, before I start today, I want to thank everyone who attended our recent ECB Intraday Liquidity Guidance webinar. Ran last week, very topical indeed. Many hundreds of people joined, mainly in Europe, but there's also interest across the rest of the world. If you missed that webinar, in the comments section on the right-hand side of the screen, we're about to post the link to that. You do have to register, but once you're through that, you can get into that webinar and hear what was said. Very interesting and obviously very topical for banks, especially in Europe. And now today, our topic is entitled Achieving Regulatory Compliance, Banks and Liquidity Management. Welcome to our audience today. Good morning, afternoon and evening, wherever you may be. Anyone in the audience can ask a question as we run through. If you ask it in the comments section on the right hand side, I can take some of these as we go. And also at the end, we've got 30 minutes to run today, and any that are left over at the end, we can answer after that. If you do ask a question, please let us know who you are and if you possibly can, your role. So we have some context, that will be great. Now, today, I'm joined by our guest speaker, Steph Hensenberg, Managing Director at Red Queen Advisory. Hi, Steph.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Steph. Would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah, sure. I'm Steph Hensenberg. I am the Managing Director of Red Queen Advisory. My background is I spent 9 years in a Big Four advisory environment. And before that, I was at the regulator, supervising a number of, I'd say, small to mid-tier banks and building societies. So very keen to talk about liquidity today.
Perfect. Someone who was actually a regulator. So You know what you're talking about. And I wondered, where does Red Queen come from? Was that are you the Red Queen or what?
So actually, there is a story behind this. There is an excerpt in Alice Through the Looking Glass where Alice is running along next to the Red Queen as the world turns underneath them. And I often use this when talking to clients about anything risk and regulation, because quite often firms get into a place where they haven't done anything for a couple of years, and then they find themselves in a sticky spot with the regulator because the world has changed underneath them. So you've got to keep running to stay standing still.
Perfect. Got it. Right. Now, everyone knows I normally talk about football at this stage as an opener. Everyone will be glad to know, or maybe not, I'm not going to talk about football or Liverpool's recent results. So let's move straight on from there. And I know you're a big fan of scuba diving. Only done it once on the Great Barrier Reef for 3 days. Exhausting activity I did. And actually, we had someone on 4 weeks ago, Barry Lewis from Elixir, who also was about to go off scuba diving. So it's your passion. Tell us a little bit more about it and where you scuba dive.
Absolutely. So I'm going to show my age. I've been diving for over 20 years and dive everywhere from the UK. I live on the South Coast and go out of Littlehampton when I can in the summer to all over the world. And actually, I just came back 2 weeks ago from the Maldives, where a highlight for me was sitting on the seabed with mantas gliding over my head. A very serene and magical experience.
Fantastic. Miles away from the Red Queen, right? But the earth's still spinning under you. Yeah. Perfect. Thanks, Steph. So look, on to the subject today, achieving regulatory compliance. And look, if we're talking about regulation and liquidity, then we've got to start with the ILAP, right? Can you bring to life, in your own words, just an overview of what it is and what it aims to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And whenever I'm talking to management teams and boards, I like to start with, it is a regulatory document, but you should be wanting to do this anyway, because the key risks for management teams are that you're going to run out of cash and not be able to meet your liabilities as they fall due, or you're not going to have enough capital to deal with significant losses. So regulation aside, it's a really important thought process for thinking about how much liquidity you need. You know, what are the things that could come up that you might not be expecting, and how can you plan to meet them? Of course, we have a big regulatory framework around it, which we're going to explore in the next questions, I'm sure. But essentially, you're looking at all the different liquidity risks, thinking about controls that you have in place, monitoring processes, and thinking about, you know, what you might want to hold as a buffer in case situations do arise.
Get it. And so it's not just, you know, we hear it many times, but it's not that you should be forced to do it or you absolutely need to do it. You should want to do it. It's a good process, right? It's good practice. And that should come first, really.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Got it. Good. Right. What about pillar one, pillar two? How does pillar two complement the regulatory compliant requirements of pillar one?
Yeah. Well, I think it's worth just reflecting on how it differs to pillar one. So pillar one is your very formulaic, rule-based components that drive the liquidity coverage ratio, the LCR, or the net stable funding ratio, the NSFR. And those are your sort of regulatory minimums that you have to meet.
Yeah.
Because they are formulaic and applied across the spectrum to all banks and building societies, they're not necessarily appropriate for your business model. They don't necessarily capture all the risks. So pillar two is about thinking through actually what our specific liquidity risks from a funding basis, from outflows, things that we need to think through and perhaps hold a little bit extra liquidity buffer for specific items or use it to drive into the stress testing.
And stress testing, look, that's a very important part of this. 10 years ago or so, it's just tell me the liquidity I need to hold intraday. But stress testing now in real time, stress testing is really important. So what role does stress testing play in the whole liquidity management piece today?
Sure. Well, I think I think any plan that you have is just that. It's a plan. It's thinking about what you hope to achieve under a base case condition. But we've all seen in, you know, recent years how things can come along, whether it is geopolitical tensions or COVID type situations or financial crises. You know, that there's a lot of change and unexpected events. So it's really getting you to think through the spectrum of things that could happen, what could go wrong, and how you might spot that coming and what actions you might take to try and address that. Now, for liquidity planning, stress tests are typically across a market-wide event. So that's your kind of macroeconomic, recessionary type situation. But also you need to think about something idiosyncratic. So what if there's something very specific that happens to your individual firm, a technology outage, for example, or a particular business line that you have that's impacted by some changes in the environment? So thinking through the spectrum of things that could happen, and for those idiosyncratic and market-wide events, you then need to bring them together in a combined. It's worth mentioning here that idiosyncratic events tend to be short and sharp. So they tend to be stress events that occur really quickly and they have a massive impact. So if we take the tech failure, you know, it happens on day one, you're going to have a big impact over a few days and then it'll gradually tail off. Whereas your macroeconomic ones, they take a long time to sort of reach a peak and then they tend to dissipate. So when you overlay them on that combined stress, you're kind of really bringing that short, sharp stress along with something that's a longer to peak and then dissipate stress.
Got it. So it's not just individual stresses that you might encounter. It's how do you add them up? What's most likely to happen? How do you forecast them? There's obviously black swan events that they're a black swan because you can't predict them, but you have to look at a reasonable number of stresses and what might happen to look at that overall view.
Exactly. And there's linkage between different regulatory processes that you have to undertake. So you know, ILAP is something that is a severe but plausible stress scenario. Of course, firms also have to do reverse stress testing, which is when you push the business model to the point of failure. And then there's things in between like recovery planning, where you're thinking about a scenario that will take the firm to the point of near failure, but it is something that you can recover from. So there's thinking about those scenarios and the linkage. Another real important point from a regulator's perspective is the learnings that you get from that process. I think a lot of firms focus on what are the assumptions, what's the number, the output becomes. And of course, that's important when you're talking about how much HQLA you need to hold. But actually, what you learn in terms of identifying the things that could cause you a liquidity problem, and how you might identify that beginning to unfurl, and how you might take actions to manage that, is almost the more important point from this.
Yeah, it is. And look, we saw that 2 years ago, I think, isn't it, with Silicon Valley Bank, that when these stresses happen and they go too far, what happens after it happens really quickly, social media impact and so on. It doesn't happen over weeks. It happens in hours, and you have to react really quickly. So it's not just what happens under stress, what happens when it goes too far, and what do I have to do? Because you have to act very quickly indeed, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It should be dynamic. And, don't just do it once a year and forget about it. Mm. Keep running those stress tests. Yeah. Use them in the ALCO packs. Think about how they might need to change for today.
So how does all this link to contingency plans like LCP or recovery options? What's the linkage there?
Yeah, so in the ILAP and ICAP, when you do your severe but plausible stresses, they ask you to articulate what the management actions are that you might take to try and rectify the situation. Historically, firms would have had a liquidity contingency plan, an LCP. Over the years, that's been integrated into the recovery plan. But really, it's your menu of things that you can do. So having gone through the thought process of thinking about these various stresses, think about what actions you can take. And this can start from really simple things like liquidating high quality liquid assets, HQLA. It can be reducing lending, so you've got less outflows. It can be drawing down on credit lines, increasing new lending. And so the LCP and the recovery options is really about listing these things so that when you are in a crisis, rather than trying to scrabble around and think, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? You've got that menu to go to, and it's been thought through a little bit to think about how quickly can we realise this? What's the impact going to be? Does it have any dependencies or linkages to other things?
And when we were at the regulator, now when you're talking to boards, do you not only look out for what contingency plans they have, but how they test them and how they validate them? Because it's all right having a plan, but you've got to have some level of testing of that plan. And obviously you can't execute a full-blown crisis because you'll be executing various actions. But you want to know that it's going to work, right?
Yeah. I mean, particularly on the liquidity side of things, anything that you've got listed as a management action, whether it is, repoing assets, drawing down on ILTR or whatever it might be, you need to test that at least annually to make sure that you've got the processes up and running and working. On a recovery sort of scale of things, that's a little bit harder to test because you're not going to sell off huge portfolios and wind down business lines under BAU. But they do expect firms to do some sort of internal assurance work, do fire drills to make sure that everyone knows how to operate when you're in that kind of crisis mode.
Got it. So OLAR, another acronym, this time a four-letter acronym, Overall Liquidity Adequacy Rule. Can you explain what it is, how significant it is? I know there's lots of acronyms out there, but what is it? What does it mean?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are so many acronyms that when I first joined the regulator, I went into what was the FSA and came out of what was the PRA. But we had a book of acronyms. It was about 20 pages long because there are so many to learn. OLAR is an interesting one. And I always like to remind firms of the history on this. So the original liquidity rules around ILAP were brought in the UK post-2007 crisis. And the equivalent of what the LCR was back then was a 90-day stress. And of course, when we were part of Europe and we moved towards the consolidated rules, we moved on to the LCR, which is a 30-day stress. And so what we've seen over the years is the PRA bringing in elements to their rule books, which get firms to think more holistically about other types of stress and how long you would want to survive in a stress environment. So the overall liquidity adequacy rule, or OLAR, is one of their tools that they use to get banks thinking about, well, LCR is 30 days. How long would you really want to be able to survive in a liquidity stress?
Yeah.
Is it 30? Is it 60? Is it 90? 120? They don't stipulate a time, but most firms end up going for 90 days because of that historic link to BiPRU. And what you do is you have to think through, LCR aside, what do we think a stress event might look like that is particularly pertinent to our balance sheet, our business model? What would we make in terms of assumptions for inflows and outflows? How long would we want to survive? And so you then set a risk appetite, which is to have enough liquidity to survive a stress of a certain period. And that is what drives that overall liquidity adequacy rule.
Got it. And I think ultimately banks, I've always thought about the, if I was sat on the other side and I was experiencing a stress event, it's probably, I have all my rules about 30 days, 90 days and so on, but ultimately it's day by day probably, isn't it? Making sure you've got everything in place and you're following the right procedures.
Absolutely. And I think it comes back to that point we were discussing around rerunning stress scenarios. So that OLAR stress changes as soon as you're one day into that projection. So being able to pivot and keep looking at it is important.
Got it. So governance frameworks, right? How do they impact liquidity management in banks? And you know, how should they practically work, Steph?
So I always think more brains are better than one, particularly middle-aged brains like mine that can get a bit forgetful. I mean, the point around having good governance and robust challenge is really to make sure that you've got different perspectives, different ways of looking at things. It brings buy-in from across teams if you're getting them involved in thinking about things that could happen and how quickly you would respond and what the processes would be. So I think there's a governance process in terms of getting people together and engaged and taking them forward. There's then the sort of the official framework that goes through. So typically there will be executive level committees where there will be challenge and refinement of scenarios, assumptions, things that drive the liquidity management framework. And of course, the board. So ultimately, they're the ones that own risk appetite. They're the ones that own the risk framework and the strategy. And so they should be involved. A frequent a challenge, I suppose, is getting their involvement early enough. All too often firms go with near completed documents, which doesn't give enough time for non-executives to really challenge those important assumptions and scenarios to get to really robust documents that the board can sign off on.
Got it. So I'm a treasurer. I'm sat at my bank. I'm about to get a review 10 years ago from Steph from the PRA. what are the kind of the common obstacles that I would face in complying with the conversation I'm going to have with you and liquidity regulations that you're going to talk to me about? How would that normally run?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's many obstacles. I mean, a lot of these rules are complex. And there's levels of interpretation. So, I mean, first off, it's just really, you know, being able to understand and interpret the rules. particularly when you've got different scales of firms. You know, we have large high street banks where there are teams of people working on this versus small building societies and new startups that have got, you know, one or two people that are trying to navigate. So yeah. Understanding and interpretation is a big one. Data management can be really tricky. Getting the right data out to be able to feed into these systems. Being able to undertake the analyses, particularly when you're thinking about rerunning stress tests on a regular basis for that monitoring component. I think in treasuries more generally, you know, segregation of duties in process and challenge is a particular issue for smaller firms where there are fewer individuals. And more recently, I have conversations around the challenge between meeting regulatory requirements and optimizing profitability, because there's a commercial element in this that's really important for treasury functions.
There is. And I've always wondered as well, banks that we have talked to, one of the challenges or obstacles that they've had is that they can sit there and they can show of the last 10 days to 30 days what happened, but the regulator is very interested in, did you actually have control at the moment of time? So when things happen, you got some peaks or troughs, or there were stresses, liquidity issues, at that moment you knew about them and you could act. It's not just after the event, the next week, 2 weeks, you look back and say, I was okay. You have to have some level of real-time control, right?
Yeah, I lost you for a second there, but I think I got the gist. I mean, I think there's an interesting link to the senior managers framework and certification regime here, because there is that point around accountability. And there are, of course, SMFs who are on paper those kind of accountable individuals. But Treasury has a lot of certified material risk takers, etc. And you're right, it's about exercising that duty. I frequently come across frameworks and ways of working which are really well designed, but they're not necessarily operating in the way that they should. And so making sure those individuals really are looking at the right things and taking the right action is just as important.
Got it. Right. Well, I mean, what are some of the best practices that you know about for ensuring compliance but maintaining liquidity? It's a balance between the two, but what are some of the things that you would point out to your customers around best practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think focusing on stress testing is always the best place to start, because it gets you thinking through what are the things that could impact our liquidity position, and how can we put in place some controls to manage that, some indicators to give us early foresight. So that's always the best place to start. Within that, justifying assumptions. So whether that is assumptions around is assumptions around how quickly you're able to initiate certain activities, how quickly you're able to realize those benefits. But justification is key. So stress scenarios and how you justify them is certainly sort of like a number one for me. I think second, I'd say integration with the broader liquidity risk management framework. It's not right to do an ILAP and have it sit on a shelf and look at it once a year. You know, really, you should be going through a process of having identified your liquidity risks and quantified them within the ILAP, having that flow through into ALCO decks, daily monitoring, so that you can really see how each of those risks to liquidity are changing over time, and you can respond appropriately. So that's really important. Of course, governance, we've mentioned it briefly, but this is key, having the right individuals, the right committees, those multiple brains to come and challenge around whether we're in a good position, how things are moving, and what you might want to do to address any changes. The final thing is HQLA, the process that you go through to identify these weaknesses and think about stresses is really to make sure that you've then got sufficient high quality liquid assets there to cover you in a stress. But thinking broader than that, what are your other assets that don't necessarily qualify as HQLA, but that you could draw down on in the early days of a stress? So I think the combination of those things would put you in good stead.
Perfect, Steph. Look, we've got it's a comment, actually. It's from Hugo Lagrotta. Good afternoon, Hugo. He says the concept of plausibility for stress scenarios. I think that really that means it's a plausible set of stresses you will overlay to look at an outcome. It's not just individual ones. It's not just a random selection of them. You have to look at a plausible reason why those stresses would happen.
Absolutely. I think this chimes with the justification point that we were discussing. How do you justify what's plausible? Well, if it's happened in the last 25 years, it's probably very plausible.
It's probably going to, yeah, exactly. Right, perfect. So I'm a treasurer, right? Regulations are changing all the time. What's my best way to prepare for what is going to change and happen in the future?
Yeah, I think we all need to get used to change just being part of the everyday. So first of all, I'd say expect there to be constant change and have the flex in your setup to be able to deal with that and manage it. Obviously, staying informed about regulatory developments, making sure you've got your email alerts, going to things like this, updating risk management frameworks and compliance procedures in line with those new requirements is all part of it.
Pretty good. Yeah, perfect. And what are various examples of innovative strategies we quite often get asked about? Where are you innovating and what's coming up and what's new? But what are examples of innovation strategies the banks are using to manage liquidity specifically that you're aware of?
I think the biggest kind of innovation really is around data and analytics. Being really able to integrate systems so that you can very quickly look at positions, forecasts, and respond. I'm aware that is leading to a lot of activity in intraday repos and activities which wouldn't have happened years ago. So I think technology and analytics is the real thing that's driving change in liquidity and treasury at the moment.
Yeah, and I think what we've seen is years ago it was just show me where I am, then it's show me where I'll be during the day and give me a rudimentary forecast. But now let's start applying advanced techniques, AI, to the forecast, because if I can manage that and get as accurate as I can, whether it's during the day or in the next few days, up to 30 days, that's the best knowledge I'm going to have to try and react. So that's the trends that we've seen. But underpinning it all is the right access to data and the right data and technology and having the right real-time tech in place. So, okay, nearly finished, Steph, nearly running out of time, but the question I always ask at the end is if there's one piece of advice that you would give the listeners today regarding this topic and liquidity management, what would it be?
It's a really nice link back into my my title of Red Queen. So I think you've got to keep moving to stand still. So never stop learning, evaluating, improving on what you do, because otherwise you'll fall behind.
Perfect. And look, we are almost out of time now, Jen. But thanks for joining us today and sharing all your views. What we're going to do, Adam's just posted Steph's email in the comments section. Steph has worked for the FSA and obviously eventually the PRA. So she's actually sat there talking to people who will be on this podcast about liquidity and all the process that they need in place. So if you do want some input, some advice on that, reach out to Steph and you'll get it firsthand in terms of what they ask. And obviously now she helps with doing that. So thanks very much for that, Steph. If anyone has questions after the event, please raise them or send them through to us and we can answer them and also ask Steph. So that concludes our latest Liquidity Talks live stream and podcast. We will be putting the podcast on LinkedIn, Spotify, Apple Music, and many other media outlets and streaming services very soon. Thank you very much for joining. Look out for our next podcast coming out next month. My name is Neville Roberts. Thank you for tuning in and goodbye.
You've been listening to Liquidity Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on the latest developments and industry opinion from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk.